So you'd mentioned earlier in the panel that you had taught yourself sound design,
yep.
And then you used YouTube to show people kind of what you do. And I'm just curious if you could elaborate a little bit more about how you used YouTube to establish that authority and if that directly led to anything.
Sure. So, like, I didn't actually start YouTube to establish anything. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things about me, I have this thing of turning my weaknesses into strengths, I guess, but I have a terrible memory, right? So when you compose, every now and again, you'll get yourself in a head mindset, right? And you'll compose a score, and then a couple of years later, you'll be in a completely different mindset, and you'll listen to your old score and you'll say to yourself, how did I do that? Like, I physically can't remember how I did that. So I started making videos to remember how I did that, you know?
Ah, okay.
And so, like, I would put the videos out, and then people started to watch them. And then I started using other people's sample libraries, and so I started, you know, putting those up on YouTube, showing how I was using those, and then it just built and built. But then it also, it transpired that because I was doing this, it made it easy for people to see what I could do. You know, like, mm-hmm. it was never intended to be a way to, like, it was never intended to be, like, a demo reel or a way to, in any way, like, advertise myself. It was just more for me and, like, the people who wanted the things. But, like, it's a great way, as it turns out, it's a great way of showing what you can do, because you have to do it in the video in order to show it. And, so I do all the sound design and synth and stuff. And then, you know, obviously, like, I met Hans Zimmer through my YouTube videos. And the same with Mike Patty from CineSamples, you know, because I've done a few of theirs. And then he introduced me to Chris Lennox, you know, and then I did some synth work on Mass Effect 3. It all came around because of these videos. And like I say, I don't think it's the videos themselves. I think it's just because I proved I knew what I was doing, mm-hmm. right? So the more I've done that, the more followers, the more people, I guess, I proved I know what I can do through them.
Yeah, right. That's awesome, though. I mean, that is exactly... my background's in marketing social media marketing and that kind of stuff, and that is, like, exactly, like, textbook. Like, hey, if you want to build authority, just, you know, demonstrate you know what you're talking about and put stuff out there to help people, and it just builds. Well,
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like, if someone was to kind of be disingenuous and want something out of it, you know, instead, I mean, you have to... I can't remember where I heard the quote, but, like, I'll say it anyway, is you have to ask yourself... Like, you have to put yourself in the person who's watching shoes and say, what's in this for me? Like, no one... Like, if you're putting your music out on the internet, like, why would someone listen to that over, like, a highly produced, you know? Like, say it's my track versus Hans Zimmer's track, like, and I'm just starting out and I'm posting my music everywhere. Why is someone going to want to listen to my, you know, stuff that I've, you know, 1 year of music education with $10 worth of sample libraries or Hans Zimmer's $1 million studio? You know what I mean? Like... It's obvious. So, like, putting the music out there, there's nothing in it for the listener. Whereas if you're helping people and you're helping people improve, you're inspiring people, there's something in them, there's a reason for them to watch. And that's why people watch my videos, because I'm not using it as a way to market me. I'm using it as a way to help people. Like, I love to help new composers get into it. I mean, particularly, like, there's a genre of music, you know, epic trailer, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of epic hybrid music.
Yep.
And there's a lot of composers in the world who don't view that as real music, you know what I mean? So it's very talked down on. And I like to stick up for those who are, like, either too scared or, like, I don't want people to be dissuaded or put off doing something they like doing just because someone else said it was crap. So, like, I use those videos as a way to, you know, help those people too.
That's awesome. A couple of my favorite marketers, they run a site called Internet Business Mastery Academy. And they say that the two most important things you can do in marketing is create value.
Right.
And it sounds like it's, like, exactly what your philosophy is. Then we can get back to philosophy.
Oh, God, not the philosophy questions again.
So I tell you, you never know where this is going to go. Cool. So you also talked a little bit about how you take, like, non-musical sounds and integrate it into, you know, your scores and your work.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, for someone who has never done that before, technically... How would that, you know, what advice would you give them starting out exploring that? Because I know that a lot of it's, like, very explorative when you first start out.
So the most important thing is that anything that makes a sound can become useful. Like, it doesn't matter what it is, like this metal post next to me, like, that's a ting. So you could, You know, that's a thing. And it's even got a thud in it, which was quite nice. You record that and you put it in the computer. And once it's in the computer, you've got like an organic sound. So then you can treat it like a synthesizer with organic sounds. So you can add filters, you can add distortion, you can add delays, and you can make it interesting. You know, when I do sound design things, it normally lands in one or two banks, either rhythmic stuff or drone stuff. So drone stuff's when you get like a really interesting texture that evolves over time. And then like, so lots of pitch shifting and delays and filters and things like that, just to make it really kind of sounding. And then rhythmic stuff is normally a lot sharper with more transients. And it's just like, I just make banks of stuff and throw it in, and it just adds to a track, you know? So like, if you're getting started, it's first off, just realize that everything that makes a sound can be a sound. And then it's just a case of figuring out, like using like general kind of orchestrational ideas. So like, you want low instruments to be few and far between because low frequencies clash. So lots of just big accents in the lows. In the mids, you can do accents, but also have like some extra, you know, grace notes, you know, some extra. And then high is where you have all the fast, ticky stuff. So like I was just hitting that post there, that would be a high instrument. So I can play that fast. If I was to stomp on this thing here and it's a low sound, you wouldn't want to do that really fast because it would sound like, and it would just sound shit. So yeah, just keep your orchestration in mind, like lows, mids and highs. And realize that absolutely anything can be. And then you just record it, like with a little hand recorder on your laptop, on your phone, like you're doing now. And then you put it in the computer. And again, once it's in the computer, you're set.
Go wild.
You're set. Because at that point, it's just digital information that you can treat exactly like a synthesizer. And then you do some things.
Now, do you find that you're collecting all these sounds and sort of molding them on a project by project basis? Like, yeah, I've got the project, I need to go out and like go explore and find some sounds, so, or
yeah, I mean, like sometimes on certain projects, like there'll be a certain type of sound. Like I just did a video game. I don't think I can say the name of it, but like it was very dark and aggressive. And I mean, I have dark and aggressive stuff, but I was like, okay, I want to try some things with like really nasty bass guitar and drum kits. So I would go off and record those. But then what I do is I make the loops and the sounds that I originally start with very generic, very easy to put in anything, and it would just work. And then once I actually get to writing the actual score, I will I'll just drag those sounds in, but then I'll manipulate them to fit whatever I'm working on at that particular moment. So I have a huge bank of the most generic like sound design things, but they all get used I actually make a point when I'm doing the soundtrack to not audition them first. So like, I make this bank of sounds, I know they're good enough to be in something. I don't listen to them first, I just drag them in and then I make them work. Okay. Because then I'm forced to be creative with what I have, so I know it's good enough to be in there, and it's like, okay, this is what I'm working with. There's something about, you know, something in that about limitation, you know, breeds creativity.
Yep.
And like, if I'm going through the bank, I can spend 10 minutes just going through loops going nope. But if I just drag one in, it's like, okay, that's my loop. How do I make this sound cool?
Right. And at the end of one of those, you have music. And at the end of those, you might have just spent, you know, an hour listening to a bunch of loops. And
yeah, exactly. So not only have I composed more music in that time, but I've also created another cool loop that I didn't have before. So I put that in the bank. And then that may end up randomly in another project, but then I'll manipulate it beyond where it was. So it's just like, I have an ever-building library of just generic bullshit that by itself makes no sense, but in context of a thing, a track, it makes, you know, all the sense in the world.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you'd mentioned also your bag of tricks, in terms of music theory and like formal music education.
Oh, yeah.
Being a bag of tricks. And just a curious random question, what's a recent bag of trick that you've learned that you either love or something that
There's a bag of, right, okay, so there's a thing, I don't know how you describe it, but it's like, I think it's called a Picardy third, right? This is really musical theory.
I'm a music teacher, so I'll...
Okay, right. So let's say, for example, you're in D minor, right? And you've got your chord progression going, but you have a moment where you want a big change, but you want it to feel like it comes from within and be heroic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, the way you'd set that up is like D minor, like F, and then G minor, throw a six on it, and then go to D major.
Yep.
And so when you hit that D major, because it's... you know, it's half in the key, but it's, you know, because of that major third now, it feels like it's risen, but it still feels like it's right, you know? That's my new bag of tricks. And that's exactly what I mean. That's a musical theory thing. And it's in my bag of tricks now because, and not because I know that the major third is risen, that's irrelevant. It's that I know that sound in particular gives me that feeling. So when I have it, that's a bag of tricks that I just happen to have learned through music theory.
Got it.
So
yeah.
Music theory itself was unimportant, but the actual learning of that movement and how it made me feel is what is the bag of tricks.
Actually, I also like it when you do the flip side thing, where you start in major and then you end on a minor.
Yeah, yeah.
The deceptive cadence ending, where it's like, happy, 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 and then you end on a sad song, and I'm just like, what happened?
It's like you're playing away in like F major being all pentatonic, and you hit that D minor at the end. It's like,
yeah. The end.
The end. Go home. They died.
Cool. Pickardy third, kids. All right. Now these are the bonus round questions. These are unusual, I think. So I'm not going to ask you all these because there's a lot of them. So what do you think are the biggest mistakes or myths that you see new composers falling victim to?
Falling into. In terms of writing music or in terms of just their careers in general?
Either way, because I think there's a completely different set of demons on both sides of those tracks.
So for writing, I think imitation, but to a point of intent. So they're intending to imitate, right? Mm-hmm. So that's okay when you're starting out and you're learning, but there comes a point where if you're competing for the same jobs as Hans Zimmer and you sound like Hans Zimmer, they're going to go for Hans Zimmer. You know what I mean? Like, there comes a point when you need to be original, and not enough people are trying to be original. The thing is too many people have heard too many soundtracks, so when they're writing something, they say to themselves, this sounds wrong. And in music, there's no such thing as wrong. There's varying degrees of dissonance, but there's no such thing as wrong depending on intent, right? So if you intended it to sound a certain way, even if, like, your ear isn't used to it, it's completely alien to you. If it's what you mean it to be and you can justify it musically, it's correct. You know, there's no such thing as a wrong sound unless you're comparing it to someone else, right? So there's not enough people trying to be unique with it. Career-wise, and this I normally get like in a bit of stick for saying, but there's too many composers who try to push themselves on other people. Like, in the panel, I mentioned, you know, Tom mentioned networking, and I said I actually dislike that word because it's very disingenuous, and it falls into that category because you see a lot of composers just going to events and things and then trying to put a business card or a demo reel, can I send you my songs, and I don't think they understand like how often that happens to people, like, and half the time they never get listened to. Mm-hmm. which is a first off, so you're wasting your time essentially,
at least half.
But as a second point, It's not irritating, like, on a personal level, but it can be irritating if you're doing it to the wrong people, you know?
Mm.
And it makes... It does look a little bit, like, desperate. Like, I couldn't get work, so I'm... Can you listen to this? Can you listen to this? And a lot of the time, it's, like... And this isn't, you know... I understand that they're new in their career. It's not the best music in the world yet, mm-hmm. right? And so what you should do is surround yourself with a group of friends you trust... Get them to listen to your music. Tell, you know, be brutally honest. Is it right? Is it wrong? Try not to go up to the Hans Zimmers or the, you know, like, or the Tom Salters or whatever and say, can you listen to my music? Because, you know what I mean? Like, their bar is so high because, mm-hmm. You know, they're so good at what they do. Their bar is so high. You shouldn't expect to be there when you've just started. So them listening to your music is irrelevant because no matter, even if they say it's good, it's probably not up to their bar yet.
Right.
So, like I say, you're just wasting your time. So what you need to do is just focus more on improving, and always just be self-critical. Like, I don't know if this was even the question, but, like, you always be self-critical and say, is this better than, like, is this above that person's bar that I'm sending it to? You know what I mean? Like, if you're below the bar of the person you're sending it to, it, you know, are they really going to listen to it properly?
So instead, you recommend, I guess, like, finding people that are either maybe just a little bit ahead of you or people that are like right next to you in the trenches.
Sorry, I did word that wrong. Like obviously, like, the best thing to do is to, you know, seek advice from people who are your betters.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, like, if you're, you know, if you're just getting started and you're approaching people who are world famous, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not saying I am, that's not what I meant by that, but, like, or you're approaching someone who, you know, you've never met before. This is the analogy I always use for it when, like, sometimes when I have to turn one down. It's like, imagine you have a friend, like, you live in a neighborhood, right? On one side you have a friend, another side you have a complete stranger who's just moved in. One day your friend comes up and asks for a bag of sugar. You give him a bag of sugar because you know him. You've made friends. You have a connection. The next day, a stranger you've never met before comes to your door and says, can I have a bag of sugar? You know what I mean?
What does, like, that even mean? What are you asking for?
exactly. But on the same point, it's like, why? Like, you've not even bothered trying to meet me. And that's the thing that irritates, mm-hmm. is that you're asking me for a favor and you've not, you know, you've never spoken to me before. You've never engaged me as a human being.
Yeah.
You just want something from me with, you know. with you. No, nothing in return. I know that sounds really dickish of me to say, but that's
how it can feel. It's the truth. And I've heard the same thing with like the analogy of going on a date and like going on the first date and proposing. It's right. Like, that's just out of context. Don't do that. It's awkward for everyone.
Yeah, so. You need to build like Tom said, like networking is important if you're referring to networking as building relationships. That is the most important thing in the industry. Because, like, I probably shouldn't say it, but in music, there's like a bar. And once you're over that bar, which isn't super high, once you're over that bar and you're good enough, then you are good enough to do it. And beyond that point, it's more the networking. It's more the people you're friends with. Not the people you have connections with. It's who you're friends with, like genuine. Like, we go out on poker nights or something, you know. When you have real friends, they're the people you want to work with. Like I say, you want to work with your friends. You want to give your friend the bag of sugar. You don't give it to the stranger just because they ask.
Right.
And that translates to everything. Like, just whatever you're interested in, become friends with people who are like-minded, and things happen. I mean, that's what I did. And, you know, like, I went from, like, in 2009, I was making fan films, and now I'm, of Metal Gear, and now I'm working on Metal Gear, you know, so... And it all became because of friends, you know, people I knew that helped me out.
Yeah, I don't think there's any coincidence that there are so many people who are getting a lot of success relatively early, right, in their careers, and they also happen to be just very nice people and generous with their time.
You'll notice that a lot of successful people are nice people too.
Yeah,
or very friendly people.
Yeah, so. That's a good thing to know, too. It makes everyone feel better. All right, so if you had... This is a little bit out there. If you had to train me, or someone else, for 4 weeks to win a video game scoring competition, and I'll give you that maybe they have like basic proficiency on their instrument and they know their way around a DAW.
Okay.
You only had 4 weeks to train them, and you had $1 million on the line. How would you spend that 4 weeks? What would you teach them? What would you be focusing on?
What kind of game? Let's go with Metal Gear.
Metal Gear, perfect.
So if it was Metal Gear, I would first off teach you the basics of how a synthesizer worked, because that information translates. So it's subtractive, you know, like you have a sound, you have an initial sound, and you cut away from it to make the following sound by filters, by pitch shifting, by effects. I'd teach you how to do that. Secondly, I'd teach you how to take those sounds and turn them into instruments to play. And then once I'd done that, I'd explain that figure out your harmonic structure now and just build loops. And then what you can do, depending on how much time, this is assuming you haven't got much, how was it, 4 weeks or something?
4 weeks, yeah.
4 weeks. And then you can spend time not focusing on the things you don't need to. So if you spent a day building a bank of loops, you could spend the rest of that week just dragging those loops in to do the bits you don't need to do again and again and again. You don't need to keep doing high hi-hat parts. You don't need to keep doing drones. You don't need to keep recreating bass lines. Once you have a bank of sounds ready to go, you're focusing solely on the music. And then I'd say develop a theme and then variate it at infinitum or whatever. I genuinely think, like, once you'd nailed a theme, like, if you took those few precursor days and just focused on one thing, sound design one day, harmonic structure on the next, melodies on the next, it may feel like you're not getting anywhere, but then once you have the rest of those 3.5 weeks, you know you've got a roadmap, you've got a blueprint, and you've got the tools to get the job done. That's how I'd do it.
That's a beautiful answer.
Thank you.
All right, so then one more for you, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
So, if you woke up tomorrow...
Hopefully I do.
Yep, and different planet, identical to Earth in every way, but you don't know anyone.
Okay.
You have all the same skills and experience that you have today.
Yeah.
But you don't know anyone. All you have is $500 and a laptop. How do you start over?
$500 and a laptop?
That's it.
Do I already have a DAW?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I've got Ableton Live.
Okay.
I'd buy a cheap microphone, one that plugged in USB so I wouldn't have to spend money on an audio interface. I'd make a whole bank of sound, so I'm already back to where I am already.
Okay. Yeah. Proven process.
Yep. And then I would buy I'd probably buy a sample library. Well, yeah, I'd buy a sample library that was contact player enabled. Sorry, this is really technical, probably not what you asked, but I'd buy one that covered an entire orchestral thing, because I can do all the synth. If I had enough money left over from that, I'd buy like a synth like Yuhi Zebra or something, you know. I'd buy Omnisphere 2. Screw that. I'd buy Omnisphere 2 and a generic kind of, not generic, but like something like Sinner Symphony Light that covers the entire orchestra, you know. Mm-hmm. It's relatively cheap. It's the basic. It's got long and shorts. That's all you really need. And I could do 90% of what I do already, you know. What else? I don't think I'd have any money left after that, but headphones. I mean, I'd buy some headphones.
Okay.
Like, or some cheap speakers if I had enough, like M-Audio ones, you know. They're cheap, they're solid, they may not be the best in certain ranges, but you get the idea, you know.
And then that takes care of the music, and then for all the, you know, the career stuff, you just do exactly what you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I'd pay for an internet connection. And then, I'm set, you know, because then I can get on YouTube, and career-wise, I can just continue doing what I do, explaining things. And I do believe in karma. I think if you're genuinely helping people with the intent of helping people, one day that karma is returned to you. You know what I mean? Like I don't do it for the karma, like, mm-hmm. but like it's just how it is. Okay, here's my rule. Just don't be a dick. There's the rule of life. Just don't be a dick.
That's pretty good advice.
Yeah. Right?
I mean,
that's what someone told me once. I'm passing down to the next generation.
That's good.
Don't be a dick.
Well, thanks so much for answering my weird questions and letting me put you on the spot. I really appreciate it. You are very nice and not a dick. And it's
and I'm
working out well.
Yeah. So. You're very nice and not a dick. I wish my mother would tell me that.
So, but thanks very much. I really appreciate it.